the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by.
Hello and welcome to Education Now. This is your host, Athena Melville, and in this November 2013 edition, Anthony Melville, Montessori teacher at Tree of Life Montessori School in Ukiah, California, joins me as we welcome Cheryl Morris, author of SNAP, Scaffolding for Numerical Synapses, Awakening Curiosity in the Number 1 to 10. Welcome, Cheryl, to the podcast Waves of Education Now. I am delighted to talk with you. I really enjoyed your book.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's just a pleasure. And welcome, Anthony. As a Montessori guide, you have had an opportunity to work with Cheryl's book in your classroom.
Indeed, I have, and it's right now we're only on three. Those of you who get the book and get a chance to look at it and see it and work with it, you'll notice you'll know what I'm talking about. And it's been a pleasure to add as a spice to my classroom and a vehicle to move through different things that we're studying in class. Shall we go into some questions?
Oh, I think that would be wonderful. Why don't you start?
All right, I have a question. So, Cheryl, what was the inspiration for your curriculum?
My inspiration came from reading a book by Michael S. Schneider entitled A Beginner's Guide to Constructing the Universe. I read his book during the time I was in Montessori teacher training, and there was a harmony, a dovetailing between his work and what I was learning about a Montessori classroom environment.
Wow.
Yes. What's his name again, Cheryl?
Michael S. Schneider.
Michael S. Snyder.
Schneider. S-C-H-N-E-I-D-E-R.
All right. And do you have children of your own, Cheryl?
Yes, I've one child, a son, with children of his own now.
Oh, so did he go to Montessori school?
He did not. He went to a typical preschool for a short time and then to a traditional public school that began with kindergarten.
And how was his experience?
I would say, for all intents and purposes, his school experience was probably much like the one I had known. It was neither that positive nor that negative for me, and I think the same for him.
I understand. I understand completely.
So I know you have Montessori training and a credential through American Montessori Society, but what drew you to the field of education?
The long and short of that would be a need to do something worthwhile, something meaningful. I knew of Montessori early on, and I was intrigued, but I let myself be guided by the bad advice, if you can, you do, and if you can't, you teach. I missed my true calling,
right,
or my proper
path. I've heard
path,
that one.
And I spent a lot of time in university courses and work outside of the education field.
So when did you first hear of Montessori? I have that question. Like, was it in college or was it when you were younger? When did you remember?
It was when I first went to college. I went to college right out of high school, but then I returned midlife. So I first knew of Montessori as a young adult. in my college years.
Yes.
It's a very different experience. Like, for me, I've known it, you know, Montessori all my life because I grew up going to Montessori school. So, but I've heard this a similar story for other people who've come to Montessori from various walks of life in America and beyond, and then they find Montessori. Most people I know have found out about Montessori through education courses, or the other way I've noticed is that when parents are looking for preschools and they find Montessori preschools and they just fall in love and then they want to become Montessori teachers.
Yeah. Well, I know that I studied a lot of about Montessori when I first had my oldest twins, and I was introduced to her by a friend named May Sakharov, who has been on this show since then. But so I was just a young mother, and I was just. She said, what is it that you want? And I told her, and she said, oh, you need to read Montessori. And so I was in love. Well, Cheryl, why did you choose to work with preschoolers?
Well, I've heard others say that the early years are far more important even than college.
And oh, yes, I believe that. I believe that birth to six.
I agree with it. And preschoolers are eager learners, and they're capable of mastering all sorts of things while playing and exploring, just interacting with their environment.
Okay. And why did you call your book Snap? Did you guys catch that? I'll say that again. Sure. Why did you call your book Snap?
Okay. I have a layman's intrigue with brain research and mm-hmm. how it relates to learning. SNAP is the beginning of an acronym, and then a playful echo of the word synapse. A synapse, for those who are unfamiliar, is the intersection between two nerve cells made up of a minute gap, which impulses pass. And then SNAP is also the sound that I can imagine hearing as these same synaptic neurons in our brains make connections when we process new data. Subsequent to training, I became interested in research about the brain, how the brain functions, and how we learn.
Yeah, that makes sense, especially I'm sure after you were learning about that, you realized how important birth to 6 years old is and how much the brain grows. And I remember when I was doing my training and in college when I was getting my degree and my teaching credential, learning how much the brain grows just in that short period of time. It's amazing.
It's amazing that Montessori intuited that.
Yes. I part of why so many place great value on Montessori methods she was ahead of her time, and she was able to intuit through her own observations of the children what is now being discovered through scientific brain research.
Right.
I think that's amazing.
It is amazing. Yeah.
Well, she was using her, you know, she was a scientist, so it makes sense that she would have those skills of observation and create a method based on observation. And responding to the children.
Right, following the child.
So SNAP, I really love that. I didn't realize when I was reading the book that that's what it was based on. As a teacher, I just went straight to the material, like how can I use this material here? And I didn't catch that. That's really cool.
Yeah, that's cool.
Glad you like it.
Well, you know, we're talking about the book now and the focus. It sounds simplistic, but believe me, the focus is 1 to 10. So could you give our listeners an example of the process, Cheryl, using the number 5?
Certainly. Besides finding and counting 5 of many things, observing each number includes exploring geometric expressions of that number. So with 5 as a focus, we'd find pentagons, pentagrams, polyhedrons such as pentagonal pyramids and pentagonal prisms, and also we would look for spirals. And here I anticipate a question the audience might have. Why spirals?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll quote from A Beginner's Guide to Constructing the Universe. Michael writes, "At first, the spiral doesn't appear to be pentagonal, but wherever you see a star, you will find a spiral rolled within it."
That's beautiful.
However much time you can give to focusing on each number, the better. I found a month for 3 to 6 year olds is a good time frame.
Uh-huh.
I would begin with some introductory activities, and the natural world can initially instill the greatest sense of wonder and curiosity. So at the nature table in the classroom or on the nature plate at home, you might have a sand dollar, a starfish, flowers or pictures of flowers with 5 petals, a pine cone, and maybe a sunflower head. One of my favorite...
Why? Oh, yes? I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. Go ahead.
Continue.
One of my favorite intro activities is to have 5 children sit in chairs to form a pentagon. Help them hold a length of yarn to delineate the shape, and then invite the other children to lie down on the floor under the shape and look up at it.
Mm-hmm.
There are threads which crisscross all areas: life skills, sensorial, math, language, and culture, including history, art, music, and science. In life skills, you might have a stitching card in the shape of a pentagon. You might have 5 petaled flowers to be arranged and fresh apples to cut in a way to see a star inside. You know how you can cut an apple and,
yes,
and see a star?
Yes.
Well, within each of all these categories, exercises are listed, easiest to more complex, and the parent or teacher chooses appropriate exercises and makes adaptations according to their children's skills and interests. For sensorial exploration, you might place tape to create a pentagon on the floor and invite the children to sit or walk on it. You can consider the average length of the children's legs and size it so that 5 can sit here and reform the shape with their legs. You might trace with your finger on a child's back or palm of his hand the number 5, or a pentagon shape. And you might have a box or tray with a 5-pound weight to push or pull on the floor.
Yes, and how about the hand, 5 fingers?
Yes, that would fit into the sensorial. Where do I put that? I put that under science. But, of course, since everything's crossing disciplines, you certainly could count your 5 fingers here.
Yes, yeah. I think it's just so great. Anthony?
Yeah, one of my questions earlier was, why a sunflower, the sunflower head? I just didn't know if, sunflowers had 5-fold rotational symmetry and reflectional symmetry like the other things that she was mentioning.
Yes.
And
yes.
I just need to look at a sunflower.
Yes.
Well, yes.
Did you want me to continue into other examples of the other areas of the classroom? Or?
Sure.
Okay.
Well, I wanted to, okay,
yeah.
Go ahead. No, that's all right.
For math, we could explore a basket containing 5 of various items: beads, pencils, apples. We can count various objects in the room by 5s. And here I found it helpful to have songs. Songs can provide help with both counting and skip counting. We would display and work with units of measure: 5 ounces, 5 pounds, inches, feet, meters, 5 minutes, 5 hours. And then for language, there are read aloud books that harmonize with the number five theme. Examples would include books like Five Little Monkeys Jumping on the Bed.
Yeah.
And there is a book I love called A Star in My Orange. And and another called My Five Senses.
Yes, My Five Senses. And what was the other book you mentioned?
A Star in My Orange.
A Star in My Orange.
The author's name is Dana Mishan Rao, R-A-U.
Uh-huh. Thank you for that. Could you repeat her name?
Dana Mishan Rao.
Thank you very much. I just want to give our listeners an opportunity to hear it more than once.
Okay.
So continue.
Alrighty. We're in language. You can invite a child to the nature table and engage him or her in conversation about the objects on display and then have him write about the objects. And depending on the child's skill level, the teacher may write the child's words and then invite him to read his story to his friends. It may not truly be reading, but he would impart his story to his friends. Tracing and pin-punching pentagonal shapes can be offered as a pre-writing skill.
Yeah.
And phrases can be explored. One example, give me five. All the young children know that. That brings us to the cultural realm, which includes a lot. And we might begin by spotlighting the words for five as we learn to count together 1 to 10 in other languages. And we would look for expressions of five on a variety of flags. For example, the flag of the U.S., the European Union flag, and the flag of the Olympic Games.
Mm-hmm.
And then to observe history and timelines, we would add to a linear display of calendar months and guide understanding of 5 months, and to the linear display of photographs of a child, adding one from his or her fifth birthday, continuing the concept of a lifetime. And I also would read stories about applicable history related to the subjects shown on currency that might be on display. For example, Abe Lincoln and Thomas Jefferson, in conjunction with display of a $5 bill and a nickel. And let's see, for art and music, I'd invite the child to the nature table once again and engage him or her in a similar conversation as with language, talking about the objects on display. But this time I would invite the child to draw or map the objects to create a still life. We print and paste and stencil pentagonal shapes. We would explore patterning properties of pentagons and sing and dance to songs like Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star and Five Little Speckled Frogs. And we would add the fifth verse to The Ants Go Marching. And we'd also introduce a performance by five instrumentalists or singers as a quintet.
Cool.
There's a lot to discover while observing five in the world of science, botany, zoology, the human body. Here we are. We count the five fingers on each hand, the five toes on each foot. We show the paw prints of animals that reveal five pads on each foot, and we might extend that into animal identification. We would show samples of the, or have samples to observe of the many flowers with five petals. We would name and sort the five groups of vertebra, mammals, birds, amphibians, reptiles, and fish. We'd talk about our five senses. We'd take a quick look at the periodic table of elements and find that five is the atomic number of boron. I say a quick look because, of course, very small children, I think, just need to have a familiarity with the periodic table, just so they'll be comfortable with it when they're older.
Yeah.
And then for budding astronomers, we can show pictures of our own spiral galaxy and then possibly identify other types. And let's see, I add additional activities, usually for connection to the outdoors. I would have children find an expression of five outside, like five rocks or five flowers. I would invite the children to sit on the patio and roll a ball to each other and talk about the shape expressed, a pentagon. And then when there's snow, and before the children begin their snow angels in the snow, I'd have them see their snow stars in the snow.
Living here in California, we always had to make sand angels.
Oh, okay.
Oh, unless we went up to the snow. Do you have more for us?
That completes five.
That's just wonderful.
That was a sampling of
I'm just curious, all these amazing things that you can do just with one just concept of five. And I'm finding that with the work that I'm doing with my kids and when starting from one to two and now we're into three. But I had a question about when you were using this curriculum with your students. I wanted to know how many students did you have in your classroom? That primary age, which is 3 to 6?
Well, I trained for early childhood, ages 3 to 6. And when I initially started at the school, I was helping, assisting and subbing in those classrooms where there were 18 to 24 3 to 6-year-olds. But as it happened, towards the end, I had a classroom of maybe just 6 to 12, the enrollment dropped because of the economy. And so I found myself in a classroom with 6 to 12 children, 2.5 to 4. I was helping them potty train,
Right.
I see. So at the beginning you had, up to 24 kids, and then the end you had there was 12, and there were younger students.
Yes, and I found it was exciting because even the very youngest children were picking up on these ideas, and we were having fun with it.
I'm sure.
I could totally see that.
Yeah, I could totally see it too. I know I had just a wonderful time with Five Little Monkeys and my grandson. And he was not two yet. And it was just fantastic. But when you say that the class size was 24, was that a teacher and an aide?
Yes.
Oh, good.
With a teacher and
so it was a 1 to 12 ratio.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think class size plays a part in the success of the process that you talk about in your book?
I feel that however a child's environment is configured, it doesn't matter really. SNAP can be an element of it.
Uh-huh.
A teacher or a classroom that has many children can find it useful just as parents or grandparents would find it easy to use to observe the numbers 1 to 10 with just one or a few children or grandchildren at home.
Yeah, okay, very good. Of being flexible and adaptable. Because it's fun, I bet it would. I bet it doesn't matter how the class size.
Yep.
Yeah, so as long as you had the space, Well, I love your focus on observing with rather than teaching to the child in the book. Mm-hmm. Could you talk to our listeners about this concept?
Well, I listened to your recent interview with Stephen Hughes.
Oh, great.
and if I may, just talk about what he spoke to this.
Yes, he did.
And the way many of us understand teaching is teachers tell. Teaching is telling, and that's how students learn. But, and he said this, there are other ways to do school. And I feel that there will always be some measure of teaching by telling, but we need to understand that preschoolers in particular are very eager learners, and they're so capable of playing and exploring, interacting with their environment, and learning all the while.
Yes. It's so true, and as a great example in my classroom of what you're talking about, there was one of this young girl this year was looking at the fish tank and saw the bubbles in the fish tank, and she said, "Oh, there's bubbles in there." Uh-huh. And I said, "Yeah." Now, I could have said, "Yeah, that's air that's being trapped by the, you know, water that is falling into," and explain the whole thing. But instead, I just took a step back and said, "Yeah, those are bubbles there." Mm-hmm. And I just asked her questions until she figured it out on her own and had ownership of the discovery.
Yes.
Which
ownership,
is really, Montessori talks about that all the time. But I totally agree with you. It's key. That's why we observe with, we don't teach to.
Well, the knowledge that they discover on their own stays with them and becomes a part of them, whereas knowledge told to them may or may not be fully absorbed. A good Montessori teacher provides the environment and it's purposefully prepared to capture the interests of the children based on the teacher's ongoing observations. And I liked how you handled the bubbles in the water.
Yeah. And that's how, you know, you should deal with, I think, in science and in general, you know, with discovery. So, I just had a question about self-direction, because, you know, Montessori classrooms, so there's a lot of self-directed time. And how do you see integrating that in with some of the – I mean, I can have some ideas because I've already been doing it in my classroom. But from your perspective, how do you kind of integrate self-directing working into the setting of SNAP?
I'll try this question. You tell me if I answer it or not. In as much as my scheme developed in a Montessori setting where children self-direct and choose their own work, elements of SNAP can be placed in various areas of the classroom across all disciplines, or they can all be contained in one package for a singular focus. But the discovery of links between different areas can be exciting for children.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an extension of how Montessori works are or were created to make cross connections between disciplines and scaffold from one level to another. Does that answer what you're asking? I'm not sure.
Yeah,
I think it does too, and I think that it's fairly obvious to you, Cheryl, and to Tony and I, how, because we worked in a Montessori classroom. But for the listeners, even the concept of self-direction, I think, is not as familiar.
Let me put it in a framework maybe for our listening audience. So
please.
So what I would imagine one would do is what Cheryl is talking about in there is you prepare this environment. It's like a buffet of things to explore, and you putting out questions, posing questions to the children when you're like maybe in a group lesson to spark interest and to get the kids' brains mulling about these concepts and these ideas and these patterns. And then when you go into like what we call a work time in Montessori, where the children are choosing their own work, I can imagine someone would have work specifically that have to do with five or with starfish or with flowers, patterns with five petals, that works out there for the children to explore and do.
So let me reflect this.
That's what I could imagine.
Yeah, so
yes.
Let me reflect this and see if when we call a group lesson, is an introduction to a new material that's going to be added to the prepared environment.
Well, or to just a concept.
Or just
like she's talking about, like a group lesson could be when the kids all get together in the middle of the circle and have the string and they make a pentagon and the kids lay down and look up. That's like a group lesson. That's when you get all the kids together.
Yeah, and so the new material is the string to make the pentagons. But I understand. And then once it's been added, then when the children go to work period, where they're selecting from this environment any whatever they want to do, they may choose to go and make those pentagons and ask friends to join them make those pentagons again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or they may choose to go work with those three-part cards that are all starfish. Or
yes.
Whatever it is that's been, you know, out there. Or maybe they're going to go draw pictures of all those flowers that have five petals.
Right.
Whatever, you know, or maybe they come up with their own.
Or maybe they use the pentagon inset and draw it and turn it and draw it again and explore and have fun with
all
it
of
as
us,
a template.
All of us Montessorians know exactly what we're saying. But,
but we need to talk about it.
So
that others understand.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you both for extending that. Can you talk to our listeners about the persons who've inspired you in education, Cheryl? I know you mentioned Dr. Stephen Hughes, and he is inspirational. Oh, man, I enjoyed him so much, and you refer to him in your book. You make a reference to him about specifically for this teaching and telling business, right?
Mm-hmm. I have just been listening to his talks now online. I've never gotten to meet Stephen, but whenever I do hear him speak, it's always very interesting, very comfortable, and I just hope more and more people get to hear him.
I do too, and I especially, you know, he and other authorities on child growth and development do not get mainstream media attention. Even from public, you know, NPR or PBS, which is just a crime because they are the experts.
Mm-hmm.
And who else has inspired you besides Steve?
Well, and besides Maria Montessori,
of course,
who has written many books, there is Angeline Stoll Lillard. Author of Montessori, The Science Behind the Genius,
mm-hmm.
and Aline D. Wolfe, author of Nurturing the Spirit.
Yes.
And then there are two educators who focus on building positive relationships between adults and children, which is very important when you're working with children. Jane Nelson, author of Positive Discipline,
mm-hmm.
and
yes.
Kim John Payne, author of Simplicity Parenting.
No, I have not heard of Simplicity Parenting, and I'm glad you mentioned it.
Yeah, I haven't heard that one.
Yeah, because I will go look at it. But Jane that you mentioned before.
Nelson.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
Jane Nelson.
Yes.
Actually, she did an address, and she asked she gave us permission for Education Now to present her address on Education Now, which we did, and I also got a chance to interview her. It was very wonderful. She is an inspirational person, and
So I'm just curious. I don't know if in terms of shifting gears here, but I was looking at the cover of the book, and I saw you mm-hmm. and this cute little boy there, and he had this contraption. It looked to me like a bead frame,
mm-hmm.
but it had all these like little blocks beneath it, and I couldn't understand the colors with the colors of the. And I was just so curious about it. I was wondering if you could maybe tell us what that material was for.
Well, you know, I'm not sure, and it's a little embarrassing. I should be sure exactly what that is. It's an abacus of one kind or another. The photo came from the company that helped me to self-publish my book.
Mm.
And I can tell you that I spent some time having them try to understand that the Montessori beads that I put into the interior of my book were not part of an abacus. And there mm-hmm. was there was a lot of turnaround because of it. I was okay mm-hmm. with the front cover image because my intent was to appeal to all teachers, parents, and caregivers, not just Montessorians. I feel that
right.
SNAP can run easily with other established procedures and elements.
Oh yes.
And yeah. Every teacher has his or her own source of crafts, music, and books. And I invite them to choose those that they have that are related to the numbers 1 to 10 and add them in.
Right. Well, cool. So I'll have to try to figure out what the thing is.
And Anthony, that is not a picture of Cheryl on the cover.
Oh, it's not?
No.
No. No.
Okay, that makes sense.
I knew that part because, you know, I've seen a picture of Cheryl, and I think I've met her at a conference. You just look so familiar to me, Cheryl.
Really? I would remember if we'd met, Athena. I would hope someday to get to meet you, but I don't think I've met you.
Well, all right, then perhaps we haven't. But it's kind of like I'm just sure I've seen her at an American Montessori Society conference.
You are feeling like a friend, though.
Oh, good. That's wonderful news. But, have you tried this approach, or has anyone you know tried it, with older or elementary students?
Well, I have not. When I first discovered Michael Schneider's book, I read the reviews at the Amazon site. And I was happy when I found a Montessorian using the material in an elementary class. And it's been months now that I was in touch with him, only briefly.
Well, I just wanted to say today, I introduced three, and I started, you know, I was showing the children three and how a Montessori, we have a pink three, and asked them to look around the classroom for other things that we had three of. So they started looking around the classroom, and one of the students just got up and she went over to the red and blue rods and she brought back the three and she said, one, two, three.
Mm-hmm.
And three. And I saw all the kids and I could feel in them. They all wanted to get up and they wanted to move around the room. So I said, get up and move around the room and find things. It was an amazing experience. All these kids were like, they were all up like, there's three of this, there's three of that. And they were like, there's three columns. And they were all going all over, grabbing different things, showing different things, and I was drawing as quick as I could on the whiteboard all the different things that they were saying and just keeping the inspiration going, and they were just sparked. So it is great.
That sounds really cool.
it was awesome, and with the kids with the level that I'm working with, they're ages five and six, and some 7-year-olds, they can take it to that next level some of the younger kids take it to a very high level of understanding and awareness, but there's more of that going on and more connections and pattern seeing that's really to see what more we can do with it. And as you can probably tell, I love the integration of so many different subjects. I'm a musician myself, and I love geometry and math. And but I was wondering if you could explain for the listening audience how geometry plays a role in the exploration of number.
And there's a quote from John Mitchell, in the intro to Michael's book that reads, "Geometry is the purest visible expression of number." That's quote. "Numbers and geometric shapes and harmonious patterns are based in nature and are reflected in the world all around us." And Michael writes that they, numbers, geometric shapes and patterns, are guides to a deep cosmic canon of design. This was a philosophy in ancient times, actually studied closely. And in 1611, Galileo wrote, "Philosophy is written in this grand book, I mean the universe, which stands continually open to our gaze, but it cannot be understood unless one first learns to comprehend the language and interpret the characters in which it is written. It is written in the language of mathematics, and its characters are triangles, circles, and other geometric figures, without which it is humanly impossible to understand a single word of it. Without these, one is wandering about in a dark labyrinth." This, to me, sounds so very Montessori.
Yes, it does. I was going to say Montessori would love that. And yes. When you said the word universe, it sort of disappeared, but Galileo said in the universe, and so just in case people didn't hear that word. And yes, it does. And the geometry basket in Montessori is just, I've had so many. I had a student not long ago, she's six, and I introduced her to the geometry basket, and she was just, you know, so, like, enthralled. And I said, "This is Esther's favorite material," and she said, "I can certainly see why." And she was just so happy and so in love, you know, with the geometry. And I feel like it's geometry is mathematics.
Of course. Yeah. Which is why I asked the question.
Yeah. It's great for our listening audience, I think.
Yes.
To hear that. And when you said Michael, can you say Michael's last name, Cheryl?
Schneider.
Michael
Once again,
Schneider.
It's Michael S. Schneider.
Right. And is he the one who you say used this with the older elementary students?
Well, no, he's the author of the book that A Beginner's Guide to Constructing the Universe.
Right.
Right.
So what was the name of the person that you said?
He was from Austin, Texas, and his name was John Schneider. Not Schneider, but
okay,
Schneider.
Okay, there we go. That's Schneider. Why I got confused. And so I wanted to clear it up for those who were listening. Thank you, Cheryl.
So I had another question, and this has to do with the Montessori great lessons. And I've been using your concept in my class, and as the listeners probably have already figured out, and I've tried very well, I tied it up with the cosmic curriculum and the Montessori great lessons. For instance, I did the study of one around the time of the first great lesson and the beginning of the universe, and then we started talking about the timeline of life, and tying in the timeline with the study of two, because it's, you know, it's the study of a line, 2 points define a line.
I so, like these tie-ins, yeah.
Yes. Were you thinking at all about the great lessons when you designed this approach?
I wasn't, at least not consciously. I studied early childhood Montessori courses, and the cosmic curriculum and the Montessori great lessons were not included.
Right.
It delights me to hear about your tie-ins. And,
right. And I will be sure, you know, as we explore it more and I find more tie-ins, I'll be sure to share them with you.
I would really like that. And
great.
I think another book needs to be written. Maybe you can write the someone who has elementary training and uses SNAP at the elementary level.
Cool.
Not to put pressure on you. But, you know, children, it'll always be that children will see and say their numbers in a linear fashion. Mm-hmm. And but don't you think it's interesting to have them practice organizing thought and retrieving information about the numbers 1 to 10 in a way than the more typical linear way?
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely.
It's more holistic. It's just much more holistic. I think Montessori would love it, and I really feel like my training, at any rate, talked about this, about finding, you know, when you introduce something, then, you know, make sure that it's reflected in the things that you bring in all subjects. That's
yes.
what I loved yeah. about this. Mm-hmm. I really love that about this. And then I am concerned that some of our listeners will not understand what we're talking about when we say the Montessori Great Lessons. And
right.
And so, you know, can you tell the listeners?
I'll clarify.
Please.
So the first great lesson is the story of the beginning of the universe up to the, you know, through to the creation of the earth. And the second great lesson is the story of life. And so this the cosmic curriculum of that Montessori like kind of breaks down these great lessons, which you actually teach every year, so that even though you have these kids for 3 years at a time in a traditional Montessori classroom, so that they're reintroduced to this, these huge concepts over. And at first, they're introduced to them as a first time experience. The second time, they're in the middle student, and the end, they're helping to teach and show this great lesson to the younger students. Mm-hmm. So, which kind of tells you why she broke it into threes. But also it has to do with developmental level, and as brain research has shown, she broke it up pretty right on. Mm-hmm. But in any case, that's what the great lessons are. They're the it's the cosmic curriculum that talks about the story of time, I guess you could say.
Yes, evolution.
Yes.
That dirty word.
And
but it's all very experiential. Like, I know when I do when I first introduce a child to the creation of the universe, I saw this lesson, I found this lesson that another Montessori teacher had used, where she would blow up a big black balloon and fill it with little, you know, sparkles and things. Can you two mm-hmm. hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
I was hearing myself as an echo for some reason, and I just hope that it's not on the recording. But and then, you know, you you have the candle there and things, you create an ambiance, and then when you say, you know, at first there was nothing, and then you pop the balloon and all this stuff flies out, you know, the big bang, right? And
yes,
and the kids who've never experienced it before, they are just wide-eyed.
Yeah.
They're wrapped.
And
yeah.
So it's not just talk.
It's all.
No, you are
offering experience.
Smells, things that you can see, touch, feel,
right.
experience. And there's also dramatic aspects to it to impress upon. The great lessons are like the longest lessons you'll ever get in Montessori. But they're really important, and they take a great deal of preparation to do.
Yeah. And then the kids have had experience and they're sitting sort of, you know, it's not their first time. And if there's a first timer there when you do it, they're all as excited because they remember their first time.
Yeah.
That's right.
And then when it goes beyond their second year and they're actually teaching that peer teaching, I mean, mm-hmm. really they absorb that information. It's just so fantastic. So we're talking about how fantastic Montessori is, and I do think that there are other viable systems. And Steve and I talked about that, you know, the child-centered mm-hmm. and the project, you know, a project approach, and I think that like schools like Waldorf, also, you know, they're all great, but of course I have my prejudice, and so I want to ask you, Cheryl, how do you see Montessori possibly being advanced?
I have wishes. I would like for Montessori administrators to help their teachers and their teachers in training to find the time and energy to speak and write to a wider audience. Mm-hmm. I feel like there is a lot of passion. A lot of passion lies within the teachers in the classroom and also those in teacher training programs. But as we all know, teachers work very hard and have very little extra time.
Right.
Lee, I would like for Montessorians of all stripes, be they current teachers or former teachers, parents, grandparents, I would like them to attend local school board meetings in order to begin introducing Montessori to those who may not be familiar, and to keep an ongoing conversation with the successes that are coming about, the successes others are having within the public sector.
Mm-hmm.
Those are my wishes. That's how I could see Montessori possibly advancing, because I feel it's got to start with parents of young children demanding of their public school systems another way, another choice. And I really believe that when you know Montessori, when you know something about it, you want to know more. And many people will want it for their own children and lament that they didn't have it for themselves.
I've had many parents like that, and I've had people come and observe, and afterwards say to me, why didn't I know about this?
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't I have this?
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, I totally, yes, I think you're right on. I think that's a wonderful way to start. And then Steve Hughes, Dr. Hughes, was saying when he was on that they're going to try to map all of the Montessori schools, public and private, and because a lot of Montessori schools are, you know, under the radar. And I know we were sort of under the radar when we had our private school, because it was, as you say, so busy. I mean, you're running a school and you're, you know, and also then you have a family.
Right.
And so it's very difficult. And so I think that's a great idea. And he said he'll let us all know when that's happening, so we can let others know. And I think that's another way to let others know. And I also think that they started Montessori in the public sector through a grant through the Trust Foundation. And I think that has taken off. And that's also wonderful. And so,
very exciting to hear about and watch.
Yes, it is. Well, first of all, I want to ask you, Cheryl, if you would tell the listening audience where they can get SNAP, where they get the book.
It's available on Amazon.
So they just go to Amazon
if they put in SNAP, Scaffolding for Numerical Synapses, it'll come up.
There you go. So you go to Google and you go to Amazon.com and you ask for SNAP, capital S-N-A-P, all that's capitalized, - Scaffolding for Numerical Synapses. And you don't need to add the Awakening Curiosity in
that's
the numbers
right.
1 to 10 because it'll just pop up with that. And then a Facebook page. Does SNAP have a Facebook page?
Yes, it does. It's of the same title.
Right. So they just, you know, anyone who's on Facebook, just up there you put in SNAP, Scaffolding, scaffolding for numerical synapses, and you'll go to the Facebook page for SNAP. And another thing I didn't tell our listeners in the very beginning is that where Cheryl is an hour later because she's in Idaho, and Anthony and I are talking to her from California. And I just thank you so very much, Cheryl, for saying...
Well, I'm honored.
Oh, I'm
much
honored
for having me.
Oh, it was such a pleasure.
You bet.
And I thank you, Anthony. I know that I'm taking you away, we're taking you away from family, and that you know, between teaching Montessori and Fanoir, you are a very busy person.
Yes.
So
no problem.
Thank you,
Anthony. Thank you, Anthony.
You bet. It was a pleasure to talk philosophy and to learn more about your book.
Oh,
and to use it in my classroom.
it's been really fun for me. I enjoyed the book so much, and I've enjoyed this. You thank your family for us for sharing you tonight, Anthony, and Cheryl, please thank your family as well. I really do appreciate it so very much.
All right.
And so this is Education Now, and saying goodbye for now, and thank you very much for listening. Bye now.
Goodbye. Snap.
Snap. Bye-bye. Bye, Cheryl. Bye, Anthony.
Bye-bye. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
You, who are on the road, must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by. Them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know.